On RN, you're with All in the Mind. I'm Lynne Malcolm. Today, alternative approaches to taming the black dog.
Let my doggy go, let my dog. Black-eyed doggy goes for more.
Depression is the most common mental health disorder, affecting around 1 million Australians, and the condition is responsible for more disability than any other cause. Chrissy is now in her 30s, but she began her struggle with depression when she was a teenager.
There wasn't a lot of acknowledgement or acceptance of the illness, and also I guess my family was going through a grieving period as my father had just died, so we all just assumed that, you know, things were going to be quite awry for a long time. But it just kind of turned into this ongoing untreated issue for me, which would come and go, and in my kind of blind way I sort of stumbled through lots of different attempts to sort it out, and when it would go I'd think, okay, now I'm better and I don't think about that anymore. But there was this sort of dread that it would come back. So I tried various things like meditation, fairly intensive meditation through my 20s, and that was effective, but I wasn't able to keep it up. I tried lots of counselling, which is effective for, you know, specific periods of life, but it wasn't necessarily treating the state itself of depression. It was more looking at specific problems. But I think also I was operating on a kind of deliberate blindness as well, because I did not want to accept it. Yeah, so eventually I had a child, and then after she was born, she was maybe, oh gosh, a few months old, and I was seeing a psychologist with the people who help with sleep with children, and she actually was the first person who said to me, you are depressed, you need to have some antidepressant drugs, I'm going to give you an appointment with a psychiatrist. So that was the first time, and that was, I was 35, that someone had sat down and made a diagnosis. So then I went on antidepressant Zoloft for quite a low dose for 3 years, and that enabled me to finish a master's. So I went back and finished a master's in visual art when my baby was one, and I was able to work like a machine, you know, I churned through it, but at the same time I flatlined emotionally.
You just couldn't feel emotions, you couldn't feel the highs.
Yeah, that's right. I didn't laugh. You know, I just went through life like a machine. You know, and actually, at first it was a real relief. It was great. But then after a while, I just felt I couldn't keep that up. I wanted to stop. So I gradually came off the medication. I did it really responsibly, just by reducing the dose very gradually. And then I had another big bout. I had some big issues in my life. My partner and I separated, and at the same time, my mother had a major stroke. And bang, you know, I didn't know what had hit me, but I was sort of struggling through it again. It was just a struggle to continue with my mothering, to continue mothering and getting my daughter to school and home, and then completing the jobs I needed to do. And so I was juggling crazily, you know, my family life and my work life, and not sleeping enough and not eating enough and being extremely irritable and really having to try and control that all the time. Yeah, so it wasn't very pleasant. I guess I'm telling this story bearing in mind that this is a condition that will play out over a long period of time. It's not like a cold where the symptoms are sudden, you feel them, you know that you're subjected to this particular illness. It can be so vague. You know, you can live through it. I guess people who have very extreme depression can't get up and they can't dress and they can't, you know. And for me, I might have a day every now and again like that, but that wouldn't be every day. But still, every day is a struggle. So I'm just sort of trying to swim and muddle through my life during these periods, and it makes it really tough.
That's Chrissy, who's now getting some relief from her depression since her involvement in a clinical trial of transcranial direct current stimulation. And more on that later. Michael Yapko is a clinical psychologist from San Diego, California. He's worked on a range of treatments for clinical depression over many years, including the use of hypnosis. He suggests that a serious revision of people's attitudes towards depression is now required, because while many people focus on the biology of depression, they miss what goes on at the psychological and social levels.
And so I really wanted to draw attention to the fact that as the data grow, it's becoming more apparent that depression is much more of a social phenomenon than a medical one.
So you are quite critical now of looking at depression as a chemical imbalance. That was the understanding that we did have in recent years. What is the basis for moving away from that?
Well, the drug companies were the one who offered that hypothesis to people without ever really proving it. And so it became very common to talk about a shortage of serotonin as the biochemical imbalance responsible for depression. The neuroscience has pretty much killed that theory. It's really not something that has credibility anymore. Most depression experts have really stopped talking about the biochemical imbalance and certainly the shortage of serotonin, and have started looking at other neurological factors, what are called trophic factors that increase certain proteins. But what we've discovered, of course, is that the drugs have not been nearly as effective as people have been led to believe. The major medical journals have been publishing article after article about the deceptions of the pharmaceutical industry in deliberately overstating their value in order to sell them. And trying to define depression as a medical illness has really backfired.
It remains, though, that many people are still very much helped by medication, aren't they?
Sure, but the question that has arisen is, why are they helped? Is it because these drugs have an active chemical value, or is this primarily about placebo effects? Depression has a very high response rate to placebo-based interventions in general. And so as the data are being reanalyzed, Using the Freedom of Information Act, a number of researchers have sued the government to get at the drug data that led to the drugs being approved in the first place. And as it turns out, when you add in all the hidden data, the value of the drugs is barely more than what you would get from a straight-out placebo effect. The expectation that the drug will be of help, that's the placebo effect.
You talked about the social levels being really important in depression and the fact that depression can be contagious. Tell me a little bit about that and how that operates.
One of the things that we have been tracking in a field called epidemiology is the prevalence of depression around the world. And in fact, the World Health Organization predicted that by the year 2020, that depression would rise to become the second greatest cause of human suffering and disability. Unfortunately, that level was already reached late last year. So depression is spreading. It's growing in every demographic group. And the obvious question is, could everybody all of a sudden have the same biochemical imbalance? Or is this, in fact, something that is being socially transmitted through a variety of means? From culture, that when you study the field of cross-national epidemiology, one of the things that you discover is that there are some cultures where depression is a fairly minimal problem, and there are other cultures where depression is huge. That lends support to the notion that people learn depressed patterns, that the kinds of things that we're seeing now, for example, the high levels of technological involvement, people spending more time in computer screens and in front of smartphones and everything else, it's no coincidence that we're seeing higher levels of depression the more that people are involved in technology. And curiously, the largest group of depression sufferers are the 25 to 44-year-olds, but the fastest growing group of depression sufferers are their children, the young people. And I think there's a lot to be said for what we're looking at in terms of social transmission as family structures change, as cultural values change, as community standards change, and they have an impact on people's outlook and an impact on people's mood. And I think that's a lot of what we're seeing.
So what led you to look to hypnosis as a therapeutic tool for the treatment of depression?
Well, one of the things to appreciate about depression is that it is in some ways a disorder of focus. That what happens in depression is that people tend to focus on what's wrong instead of what's right, what has hurt them instead of what has helped them. They focus on things that work against them. And hypnosis is a focusing process. And one of the things that really attracted me to hypnosis was that here was an efficient way of securing somebody's attention and starting to guide it actively in the direction of focusing on what's positive, what's useful. And that in itself is enough of a reason to want to use hypnosis as a part of treatment. But one of the things that I really appreciate about hypnosis is that it encourages a greater flexibility, a greater willingness to have experiences that go beyond just feelings or just rationality and give people a chance to connect with and develop parts of themselves that are the best parts of themselves and the parts of themselves that just haven't been very well developed yet.
So it frees up someone's mind to sort of think beyond their immediate pattern of thinking.
I think that's a fair way of describing it.
So I wonder if you could explain a hypnosis session and how you would use that as a pathway through a depressed state for someone.
Well, let me give you an example of someone who is taking things very personally that really aren't personal, so that if somebody doesn't call them back right away, they get upset, they feel betrayed, they feel abandoned, they feel rejected. So in doing hypnosis, to be able to invite the person to close their eyes and start to focus themselves, and then I can lead them through a series of examples of how people can misinterpret things that other people do. And then little by little, start to orient the person to the idea that so much of life is ambiguous. And in a sense, this is one of the patterns of depression, that people have a hard time with ambiguous situations. And what depressed people tend to do is interpret things in ways that hurt them. So I want to use the hypnosis to teach this person to recognize ambiguous situations before they even get in there and to take extra care not to interpret things in ways that are going to be self-damaging. We want to encourage greater cognitive flexibility. And when you can start generating multiple viewpoints for the same event, you're starting to evolve some flexibility.
Just lastly, what do we know about the success rates in terms of research of different approaches to treating depression, incorporating hypnosis, cognitive behavioral therapy, antidepressants? Has there been research that shows success rates and compares them?
Absolutely. There is a huge domain of research called therapeutic efficacy research. It's one of the most important questions you could have asked. What do we know about treatment success rates? Well, here's what we do know to this point. There are a number of psychotherapies, cognitive behavioral therapy, and interpersonal therapy in particular, that have the highest treatment success rates. Cognitive therapy teaches people skills. It helps people with information processing, clearer thinking, better quality of decision making. Interpersonal therapy focuses on the social side, the relationships. Given how often relationship issues lead people into depression, divorces, betrayals, abuses, violence, all the kinds of things that can happen in relationships that lead people into depression, the interpersonal model really focuses on teaching social skills and helping people build more positive and healthier relationships. But looking across treatment models, what we've also learned is that there's a factor called behavioral activation that really catalyzes the effects of good therapy. And what behavioral activation means is that the more active the person is in treatment, the more they are actively experimenting with their perceptions, challenging their beliefs, practicing new skills actively, the better they do in treatment. And when we look at the role of medications, medication is very so-so. It doesn't work for everybody. It's really a 50-50 chance whether somebody's going to benefit. But the other side of it is just taking the medication alone is under treatment. Just taking drugs alone has the highest rate of relapse of any form of treatment. It's just not the best choice as a sole form of treatment. So I wouldn't mind if doctors were prescribing antidepressants if they were much, much more determined and consistent about encouraging people to also engage in good skill-building therapies. The fact that we have kind of let the medical model predominate has really set us back in some ways. Now that we're starting to understand how much more powerful social forces are, I think people need to adjust their expectations accordingly so that they can feel good about themselves, who they are, and how they live.
Michael Yapko, clinical psychologist from San Diego and author of a number of books on depression, and I'll put some of those details on the All in the Mind website. You're with All in the Mind on RN, Radio Australia, online and on your mobile device. I'm Lynn Malcolm. Today, some alternative approaches to treating depression. While some clinicians, like Michael Yapko, are concerned that cultural and social factors have too often been overlooked in past treatments, other researchers are investigating the potential of using techniques based in neuroscience, like brain stimulation.
The first time it happened, I was a little bit scared because most of us have probably seen One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and that's what I was thinking about. And I managed to joke about that with the psychiatrist at the time. So I sat in a chair and my head was measured. And this happens every treatment. My head is measured so that they can find the center point on the top of my skull, and then from there they can work out where to put the electrodes on the sides of my head. And then they strap these electrodes on with a really wide rubber band. And that's the kind of the crazy lady part. It looks very strange. So I sit in the chair very still. They turn on the machine, and I feel a very light, sometimes burning, sometimes tingling sensation going through my brain.
That's Chrissy, who's participating in a trial of non-invasive brain stimulation as a treatment for depression. Electroconvulsive therapy, or ECT, might spring to mind at the mention of brain stimulation. And of course, like Chrissy, you may also think of how it was depicted in the film One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. ECT has been used over many years as an effective treatment for severe depression. But a new form of brain stimulation, using a much milder electric current, is now being trialled at the Black Dog Institute in Sydney. It's called transcranial direct current stimulation, or TDCS. Professor Colleen Liu from the School of Psychiatry at the University of New South Wales and the Black Dog Institute leads the research team.
TDCS uses a tiny electrical current, so we're talking about 1/500th the current of what is used in ECT, and that gently stimulates the surface of the brain. We're kind of trickling in this tiny little current for 20 to 30 minutes, but what has been shown in both physiological studies and also clinical studies is that it does actually change your brain's functioning, and that in depression, you know, there have been now about 6 or 7 kind of placebo-controlled trials, people don't know whether they're receiving the treatment or not, and which have shown that it has antidepressant effects. So it's a very exciting new development.
What's understood about the mechanism that actually relieves depression? Why does it work?
Yeah, so there are different ways of understanding what happens at the brain level when you're depressed, and we're still, you know, developing our understanding of this. And one of them, Lynn, is that, you know, the brain is a very sophisticated machine. There are many different parts of the brain, each of which does different things. And in a sense, sitting on top of all of these parts is the frontal part of your brain, which is a bit like the, you know, command and control center. So that needs to be active and to, in a sense, have that kind of top-down kind of control and kind of modulation of what the rest of the brain is doing. So one of the most consistent findings of brain functioning when people are depressed is that that frontal part of the brain is underactive. And then often then you also see overactivity in other parts of the brain, including parts of the brain that are involved in emotion. So if you think about how that relates to what we see clinically, you see that sometimes people are overwhelmed by their emotions, or they, you know, they ruminate and they just can't control all these very strong and in depression, you know, negative feelings. So one of the theories of depression is that that top-down control isn't working, that part of the brain is not functioning adequately, and that everything is kind of out of balance. And it's exciting because what some of the emerging evidence is starting to show is that effective treatments affect the whole kind of connection, the kind of the functional connectivity, it said, between these different parts of the brain. So it's kind of, it restores the balance between these different parts of the brain.
And what are the trials showing so far about its effectiveness?
The trials are looking very good. We've completed 2 clinical trials and we're now on to our 3rd and 4th trials. So in the trials, people receive the real treatment or something that feels like the real treatment, and we measure their mood and see whether they're getting better. So the trials on the whole look very promising, that people are getting better with this treatment. Of course, in all of our trials, people can go on to receive the real treatment, and we're also seeing that as we extend the treatment, the results are even better.
Colleen Liu says that this TDCS treatment is best used for people with clinical depression who haven't responded to other treatments. There are very few, if any, side effects, and some participants have even noticed benefits beyond changing their moods.
Yeah, so this was very exciting. So, you know, when we did our first depression trial, we were measuring things like memory and thinking. You know, it was just to be safe to check these things. And one of the things we measured was we asked people to do a test, which really showed you how quickly their brain was working. And as people went through the trial, they were saying things like, gee, I don't know what kind of stimulation I'm having, but, you know, it's almost like my brain clears and I can concentrate and think so much more clearly after the stimulation. So we were very excited when we got to the end of the study and we formally analyzed the results of the formal tests that it showed exactly what people were saying to us, that after the active stimulation, the actual thinking speed was faster, and that has led our team to develop a whole parallel line of research of using TDCS to improve memory and thinking. So our main line of research is in treating depression, but I also have a very promising young researcher who's a clinical neuropsychologist, Dr. Donald Martin, who's heading a whole program of research into using this to improve memory and thinking, for example, in people who are older and who are just starting to notice some changes in their memory and thinking. We find that people really like TDCS, and in fact, if you look on the internet, there's a whole kind of a do-it-yourself movement where they encourage people to, you know, buy a machine off the internet. They're not the same as the machines we use. These are a few hundred dollars. I don't think they're quite as carefully designed in terms of all the built-in checks and balances. And they kind of tell you, oh, well, you could do this at home by yourself. And it's promoted not just for treating illness, but for people who are well, that, you know, you could improve your gaming ability by doing TDCS while you're playing computer games, for example. I mean, I have a number of concerns about this. One is that we've found that, you know, the whole technique that you use is very important. If you don't do it correctly, you can actually damage the skin, or if you continue with the stimulation, even cause, you know, mild skin burns. Another one is that, you know, we've very carefully studied for a number of years exactly where you should put the electrodes and what kind of stimulation parameters work best. Because my concern is if you buy one of these off the internet, you don't really know anything about it, you know, you kind of read the brief instructions that come with it, then you could be putting the electrodes in the wrong place. And because these techniques do actually change your brain functioning, you could actually be changing your brain functioning for the worse. And then again, people might think, oh, you know, I did 5 minutes, it was good, 10 minutes is better, 1 hour is even better, doing it 10 times a day might be even better, and who knows what they might be doing to themselves.
Professor Colleen Liu. Chrissy has been in the TDCS program at the Black Dog Institute since the beginning of this year, and she feels that her depression symptoms have significantly improved.
Well, I can function. You know, I feel quite normal. My mood swings and my highs and my lows are manageable, that I'm not sort of overtaken by this tide of negative emotion. I mean, I think negative emotion is really natural and normal, but in depression it just gets really out of balance. So the trial's been really great for that. It's the treatment itself, but at the same time, you know, every time I go in, I have to evaluate my emotion. And in a sense, there's been this kind of therapeutic response to that too, because I now just habitually go, well, how am I today? And I'm just a bit more aware of my vulnerability and the sort of imbalances that I can have. It's such a funny beast, depression. It can really trick you, and you can trick it. You know, it's like flicking switches sometimes. Very strange.
So overall, do you feel positive about this treatment, that it's been good for your depression?
Yes, absolutely. I'm operating in a really good sort of level, really amazing treatment. You know, one of the big reasons I'm talking to you today is because I think it should be in mainstream treatment. I think we should be talking about this in the public realm and getting it out there. There's no fallout for the patient. They don't have to take medication. Your medication's, it's kind of a last resort. I can't say it didn't help me. It helped me. But there's a cost. You know, there's always a little bit of fallout trying to get the balances right. And some people it doesn't affect so well, you know. And look, I know that with this particular treatment, it's not going to treat everybody successfully either. But if we had this in the mix, just in the broader health community, then it would really help a lot of people.
Thanks to Chrissy for sharing her experience with us today. This TDCS treatment is not yet available outside of the research trials, but Colleen Liu sees some promising potential for it in the future.
Yeah, so we're interested in a number of things. One is looking at all the potential applications. So depression, I think, is a very promising field. And you know, I think we might well find ourselves in a few years' time looking at TDCS translating to becoming a clinical treatment. But then other disorders, such as people who have cognitive problems, either because they're elderly and they're starting to lose their memory, we're also collaborating with other people and looking at, say, people who've had traumatic brain injury. You know, could this be a useful part of the rehabilitation in rebuilding their brain circuit? So you combine it with, you know, they do kind of training exercises, and at the same time, you give them a boost by stimulating their brain alongside. In collaboration with other people, we're also looking at, can this be useful in other illnesses such as schizophrenia, which again is another brain-based disorder. Another line of research is, you know, how can we improve the way we give the stimulation? You know, what should be exactly the type of electrodes we use? What should be their size? What are the best parameters for giving the stimulation? And then, of course, we're also trying to understand, say, coming back to depression, what kind of people do best with this? Because depression is very complex. You know, we talk about depression as if there's one type of thing, but there are many different types of depression. And, you know, which types of depression, what kind of people are the most likely to get better?
Professor Colleen Liu from the Black Dog Institute and the University of New South Wales. Head to the All in the Mind website for details on today's program, and you might like to share some of your thoughts in the comments section at the bottom of the page. We always love to hear from you. Thanks to the team, Diane Dean and Phil McKellar. I'm Lynn Malcolm. Join me again next week. Bye for now.
But I don't equal that my dog. But I don't equal for more.